Unseen Diversity, Lecture 6, The Extremophiles.
In this lecture, I talk about extremophiles, which is a wonderful word. Extreme, phile means loving, so loving of extremes. And for many years, this was said almost as one and the same as the archaea, even before the archaea were known as their own distinctive group. There was something about them that was considered to be a little bit different, a little bit odd, not the usual purview of a microbiology class, partly because it was difficult to get many of them into the laboratory and into culture. And extremophile and archaea began to be said together as though they were one and the same thing. In fact, there are bacteria who also enjoy extreme environments, who love extreme environments. But this lecture will give me a chance to focus in on the archaea a little more and to even give you some field marks and habitats of archaea that will allow you to spot them in the wild. And it's the extreme nature of the particular archaea that I will focus on that allows them to be easily seen, or more easily than certain other archaea or bacteria. So recall that the origin of life was most likely very hot, and that the first lineages of bacteria and archaea at the base of the family tree of all organisms tend to be hyperthermophilic, extreme heat lovers. And by extreme heat, I mean some of these bacteria and archaea can grow at boiling temperatures. Now, you have an opportunity to see some of them. There are two major places on Earth now where hyperthermophilic bacteria and archaea can be observed. One requires a research submersible, which is not a likely venue for typical observation by ordinary folks who are not researchers. But let me start with that to explain how exciting that research is and what sorts of things people are seeing. They take little research submarines, often in a spherical or ovoid shape, to withstand the extreme pressures that are going to be encountered, because they're going to take them 3 miles down or more into the deepest parts of the Pacific Ocean and the deepest parts of the Atlantic Ocean. And in the case of the Pacific Ocean, they take them down into these deep sea vent or rift areas. It's pitch black down there, of course, and originally when those submersible research submarines, which sometimes hold only 2 people, descended to those depths, there was no particular certainty that there would be much of anything in the way of organisms down there. The great surprise was where these vents are occurring in the deepest part of the ocean, where enormous continental plates are moving apart or moving in some way in respect to each other, past each other. Up is coming boiling hot water from the depths, and up is coming, in some cases, molten rock in the form of lava of one sort or another. And the great surprise was that in that freezing cold black water, where the boiling water is mixing in, is a place with elaborate, complicated, wonderful communities of organisms, all based on the activities of bacteria and archaea, who can dwell in those boiling temperatures. By the way, not boiling for long. As soon as that boiling water hits the freezing cold ocean water, you immediately get a gradient of warm to then cool to then cold water. But right in the middle of the place where the hottest of water is spewing out, there are bacteria that are doing just fine there, and those are hyperthermophilic bacteria and archaea. I will say a little more about that particular community in a subsequent lecture. There's some very interesting things going on in the deep sea vent hyperthermophilic communities. But let me foreshadow a little bit. It's not just bacteria and archaea. They are growing so abundantly and so wonderfully and doing so extremely well with cycling nutrients amongst themselves that they can also support a large, diverse, and morphologically interesting community of animals. So the big surprise for researchers who went down in that submersible for the first time was that they saw, first of all, a community of animals deep, deep, deep in the ocean. And it was later that they realized it was being supported by a community of hyperthermophilic bacteria and archaea. But that's off limits to ordinary naturalists. It's off limits to me. I've never seen that with my own eyes. I've only seen videos taken from submersibles, and you can go on the internet and probably see for yourself videos taken from submersibles, and that may be the closest that, that you or I gets to see a deep sea thermal vent. However, there is one place on land that is just the most remarkable venue for observing hyperthermophilic bacteria and archaea, and that is Yellowstone National Park. And I talk it up in a particular way when I do talk about it as a pilgrimage for anyone interested in microbiology, for anyone interested in bacteriology, for anyone who wants to expand that aspect of their natural history studies. It's the most remarkable area. It is a place that really should geologically be on an ocean floor somewhere, but due to some peculiarities of geology, finds itself essentially in Wyoming. It is a place that is roughly analogous to some ocean floor activities that are occurring along the Pacific Vent and in the vicinity of the Hawaiian Islands. Yet again, there it is in Wyoming, there for us to see because we're terrestrial organisms, and here's our chance to see this. The Earth's crust is extremely thin in the area of Yellowstone. It's an area of great plate movement of the sort that you see typically in vent areas of deep oceans. And yet again, there it is on dry land, and we can get a look at it easily. Even better than that, unlike other thermal vent terrestrial environments on Earth, this one is pristine. Many of them have been exploited for energy. It's an obvious thing to do. You have got hot water spewing out of the ground. Why not harness some of that and use it for hot water and use it for heat? So there are other places around the world where there are terrestrial hot springs in huge abundance, but many of those have been taken over by industries that want to use that kind of energy. And what's really remarkable about Yellowstone is it's pristine. The other remarkable thing is that it's safe. And these areas are intrinsically unsafe. The ground can be unstable. The water is boiling. The water can be extremely acidic. The waters can be unfathomably deep. I mean, some of these go deep, deep into the earth, some of these bodies of water. Yet the National Park Service has put boardwalks everywhere so that you can walk in safety past the most dangerous of features and look down into them and look across at them and be in the vicinity of steam and geysers, et cetera. It's remarkable because I've been to some other places that have hot springs, but none as spectacular as Yellowstone. So that was a little advertisement for Yellowstone National Park. I think it's worth going to, and even if you went at one point and observed buffalo and observed lodgepole pines and the other major organisms that they've got there, you might want to consider going again because this time maybe focusing on the hyperthermophiles. By the way, the National Park Service at Yellowstone is more and more and more every year knowledgeable about the bacteria and archaea that they have. And so more and more of the signage at Yellowstone focuses on the bacteria and the archaea that are in the features. So let's say that we're at Yellowstone and we're ignoring the buffalo, which are there by the hundreds and thousands, and we're ignoring the lodgepole pines, which are the predominant trees there, and we're focusing in on a pool, and we happen to know that its temperature is something above 80 degrees centigrade, with 100 degrees centigrade being boiling. Between 80 and 100 degrees centigrade is the realm of the hyperthermophiles. It's been defined as the realm of the hyperthermophiles. And the amazing thing that you see in that pool that is somewhere between 80 and 100 degrees is all different colors, almost a rainbow of colors, reds and oranges and yellows. And the texture, although you wouldn't touch it because the water is near boiling, but the texture, you can see the texture. You can see that there's a certain slimy, kind of flocculent, scummy quality to those colors. And what you're essentially looking at are the field marks, as well as the habitat of hyperthermophilic bacteria and archaea. And there are ways to look at the colors and to look exactly at the temperature that those colors happen to be in, and to even narrow down further exactly which hyperthermophiles you're looking at. I won't actually get into that specific an aspect of this, because I think it's an accomplishment by itself just to know that you're looking at two deep lineages of bacteria and archaea right there between that temperature of 80 and 100 degrees and nothing else. There's nothing else that will grow there except for the hyperthermophilic bacteria and archaea. Now, one of the really famous bacteria that dwells at those temperatures at Yellowstone and at some other venues of that temperature is a famous bacterium called Thermus aquaticus. And it is the bacterium from which an enzyme protein was isolated to do what's called the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. Now, PCR is a process by which large quantities of DNA can be extracted and multiplied in the laboratory for the purpose of then doing further research on that DNA. So it's an extremely important technique. It happens best at hot temperatures, for reasons that I won't get into, and it happens partly because the major enzyme, the major molecule that's making the PCR reaction occur, is coming from a hot spring organism. So Thermus aquaticus is the famous bacterium of Yellowstone from the hyperthermophilic areas of Yellowstone. Its nickname, by the way, or its abbreviated name is TAC. So it's the T from Thermus, and it's the AQ from aquaticus. So it's TAC, T-A-Q is the nickname for it. And if you're looking it up or reading more about it, look for TAC as the nickname for what that is, and realize that it's a Yellowstone organism. In other sections of Yellowstone, it's not so much that you see colors in those hot waters that are greater than 80 degrees centigrade, somewhere between 80 and 100 degrees centigrade, but rather you see mud. These are boiling mud pots. Some of them are at a full rolling boil, and they're absolutely dense with mud. The mud is popping and splattering, and they're extremely acidic. You can smell the acid in the air. You can smell sulfur in the air. Really dangerous looking features. Again, you're standing on a boardwalk. You're safe. You're looking down into the feature. And when you look into that feature, you're looking at an environment where essentially only hyperthermophilic archaea can dwell. So here again is another example of my combining habitat and field mark. The beautiful thing about that is you can say with confidence, in that boiling hot mud pot, there is nothing, or that mud pool, there is nothing but hyperthermophilic archaea. There are no hyperthermophilic bacteria in there, and there is certainly no bacteria or archaea that can handle lower temperatures. Now, between 60 and 80 degrees is the group of bacteria and archaea that are characterized as thermophilic. And you can see that the scale I'm talking about has been neatly divided in 20-degree increments so far. Something will happen as we get a little bit lower, but so far we've gone from 60 to 80 to 100. So we've got a definition for thermophiles and a definition for hyperthermophiles. Where can you find thermophiles? Yellowstone Park, because just as soon as you get away from the boiling hot center of a feature, a boiling hot geyser or a boiling hot spring or a boiling hot steam vent, your water and your steam, which condenses, of course, eventually goes to whatever the ambient temperature is of the park. It cools down. And so you're going to have an entire gradient of warm to cool around pretty much every single feature at Yellowstone. And in that gradient, you're going to gradually go from 100 degrees to 80 degrees, down to 60 degrees, and down to cooler, often with bands of color corresponding, almost rainbow-like, coming out from the feature. And so between 60 and 80 is the realm of the archaea that are thermophilic, mainly because of their temperature. And again, you can look at that with confidence, knowing that you're not seeing any other organisms except for those deep thermophilic lineages. Now, things get interesting with the temperature scale when we get below 60 degrees. And I think this is another wonderful example of a field in flux, a field in which things are not quite settled yet as to how we should use the terminology. It's because for many, many, many years, scientists were convinced, including microbiologists, that nothing, absolutely nothing, could grow greater than 60 degrees centigrade. And in fact, 60 degrees centigrade was traditionally pegged in textbooks everywhere is the temperature at which proteins would fall apart, DNA would fall apart, RNA would fall apart. It was impossible to have any of those maintained higher than 60 degrees. That process of falling apart, by the way, is called denaturation. So above 60 degrees, everything would be denatured, and we might as well not even look. So it was a huge innovation even to look above 60 degrees. And in Yellowstone, by the way, was one of the first places where people went seriously looking and made those remarkable discoveries of thermophiles and hyperthermophiles. Meanwhile, a very different temperature range and set of terminology had been developed. And so you can still find in textbooks, especially textbooks with an orientation toward bacteria that are pathogens or bacteria that are associated with us, with humans, you can still find that thermophiles are those bacteria that grow between 45 degrees and 60 degrees. Okay, so there's another sort of, meanwhile, in a parallel universe, we have these other thermophiles. Now, who are they? Well, those are some of the compost heap thermophiles that will sometimes heat up a compost pile, especially if the compost pile is well contained and has been maintained properly, will heat that compost pile up with the heat of their own fermentative activities, with their own metabolism. And that compost pile can get pretty toasty. And sometimes on a cool day, you'll see compost piles steaming from this heat. And for a long time, those were the thermophiles. And I'm mentioning this only because if you decide to look into thermophiles a little bit more, you will find this other area of thermophiles that doesn't seem to match what I've been explaining to you about Yellowstone. So I would say those are less than thermophiles at this point, but there's another problem. For many, many years, microbiology has been presented from the point of view of ourselves, humans, and our body temperature is 37 degrees approximately centigrade. And room temperature for us, what we would call comfortable room temperature, is 25 degrees centigrade. And so for many years, the whole temperature scale began there and then moved up in increments towards 60 degrees, which was the old high point. And so what we end up with that older scale, which still appears sometimes, is sort of a truncated range in which the heat-loving bacteria can be placed. And now what we have, especially now that we have this much greater understanding of the real high range of temperature-loving bacteria, is we've got a much wider scale. But it's also why we don't go by the 20 degrees once we get below 60. Okay, we come to a rest somewhere in the middle of our own favorite temperature ranges, and we call that mesophilic. So the mesophiles are round about our own temperature range, just like us. By the way, there are also cryophiles, and those are cold-loving organisms. And their scale also still needs a bit of work as to exactly where they begin and where they end. And again, it's part of the old legacy of our own selves being of a particular temperature. And we also know relatively little so far about cryophiles. That is definitely an emerging field of microbiology, cold-loving organisms. And the more the poles are explored and the ice and water under the poles are explored, the more that set of temperature ranges will be expanded and better understood. And maybe at some point there'll be a coherent scale for all of those various extremophiles. Now, the next group of extremophiles that I want to address are the halophiles. Those are the salt lovers, halophiles. And they are almost all archaea, so this gives me a chance to give you another archaeal field mark. And this one also is visible in a number of different venues. One of them is if you happen to be in a place where there are either natural salt urns, that is natural places where salt is evaporating and forming a salty crust on the surface of the earth. And some of these places, by the way, will actually have the word salt in them. So it will be the salt licks or the salt flats or the salt something else. You can actually find them on maps. Or if you're at a commercial salt works, a place where a natural salt evaporating area has been turned into more of a commercial enterprise for the purpose of getting salt for food and salt for putting on roads and for various industrial processes. If you're at either of those areas, either looking from the ground or, even better, looking from the air, if you are flying over such an area, you will see a beautiful patchwork of pinks and reds and oranges, especially in a commercial salt works where different pools have been segregated and different states of salt and evaporating salt are being maintained in a regular sort of way. You'll see a gorgeous patchwork of all different shades of pinks and oranges and reds. If you go to a natural salt urn, then there won't be so much of a patchwork effect, but you'll very definitely see a sort of a pinkish to orangish tint to that salt that is either crystallizing out and forming solid crystals or is in the process of doing so. And what you're essentially seeing there are halophilic archaea. It's a group unto itself, and it's got a very unusual metabolism that I will describe to you. Although, as soon as I say the word unusual there, I'll say that for many years it seemed extremely unusual. There may be something new developing around that, such that it will turn out to be not as unusual as we once thought. Before I get to that strange metabolism, though, let me tell you the third place that you might be able to see this pink-tinted salt or pink-tinted water that is evaporating to make salt, and that is piles of road salt that are being maintained probably all over the colder parts of the United States for the purpose of putting on roads in the wintertime are sometimes kept indoors or kept under a cover and therefore kept relatively dry, but sometimes they're left out a little bit and can get damp. And some of those same bacteria, those same halophilic archaea that were in the original commercial salt work that produced that road salt will have been carried along with it and will turn parts of that pile of salt pink. And when you see that, you should say, aha, there it is. Those are halophilic archaea that I'm looking at. Now, it's even more interesting, especially if you have a little story to tell about them. They're not just halophilic archaea. They're halophilic archaea that are doing something really different with their metabolism. That pink color or that reddish color is rhodopsin. And it happens to be the same rhodopsin that we have in our eyes that is allowing us to pick up light and to process it or to be at the beginning part of the process of detecting light by our eyes. So our retina has rhodopsin in it, and so do these bacteria, and it happens to be a reddish pink pigment. That's the rhodo part of the rhodopsin. The opsin part, by the way, implies that it was originally isolated from eyes. And here's what they're doing with it. They are using it as a little solar-powered pump. They are, for the most part, heterotrophs, just like us. And so they are eating whatever food is available, just like us. Except let me pause for a second there. They're not munching on the food, just like us. Their food is nutrients that they absorb through their cell membranes. So at no point are they taking up food in the sense that we take up food. But whatever nutrients are in their environment, they're taking up with their cell membranes and processing it just like us. So they're heterotrophs. They're food eaters. But that's not all they are. They are also users of a solar-powered pump, which allows them to get a little extra energy from the light of the sun. And at first glance, you might say, well, isn't that just like plants? Aren't plants getting energy from the light of the sun? And I will say, no, it's not just like plants. It's really something remarkably different. Because remember, I just said these are heterotrophs. So they're taking up food from their environment, just as we do. What the rhodopsin solar-powered pump seems to be about is a supplement. And here's an analogy that may help you. Your home may have a furnace that burns fuel, okay, which is just like a heterotroph using food and burning that food and using that for energy. So that's what we do. We're furnace-like in our use of a fuel or food, and so are the halophilic archaea. But in addition, your house might have a solar panel to supplement that energy and to take just a little bit of energy from the sun and process it to give a little extra something to the energy use of your household. So it's a combination of a furnace and a solar panel. That's what's going on with these halophilic archaea. Now, for a long, long time, this was thought to be fascinating, maybe even exploitable in an industrial way, by the way. Not just fascinating, but people thought, well, solar-powered pump, little chemical solar-powered pump, let's see where we can go with that. So not just fascinating, but potentially exploitable, but limited to these strange archaea who are essentially sunbathing out on these open salt flats where the sun is shining hotly. That's why they're wonderful salt flats and where they're getting this additional energy. And that's it. It was exceptional. Well, I think we're changing our minds about that. Recently, there have been some genome projects that have involved sailing around the world or steaming around the world, taking water samples every few miles, looking at all of the DNA in those water samples, not necessarily taking out every single bacterium and not necessarily bringing them into the lab and not getting them onto petri plates, but just getting the DNA out of them and sequencing that DNA and looking through those DNA sequences. And guess what? Lots and lots and lots of genes for rhodopsin. So it's very suggestive that open ocean bacteria are also supplementing their regular metabolism with little solar-powered pumps. The jury's still a little bit out on exactly how that's happening and how frequently it's happening. Right at this point, it's just been noticed that an awful lot of rhodopsin is being produced out on the open ocean. So maybe this is not such an uncommon phenomenon. Maybe it's a fairly typical way for bacteria to supplement ordinary food consumption. So those are halophiles, and they've got a little story with them, so they're worth talking about and they're worth seeking out. Even if you're not in an area where there are salt works or salt turns, you may be able to see them in piles of road salt. You can also, by the way, go to a gourmet shop and purchase salt that has been processed pretty directly from a saltern type environment and which may still have a pinkish tint to it. Especially if it's being sold as something very special and very natural and very organic. And if it's got a little pinkish tint to it, those are probably halophilic bacteria or the remains of halophilic bacteria, which, of course, are not pathogens. They just are on the salt and are part of it being very natural and organic. So that's yet another place where you could catch a little glimpse of those and have an opportunity to explain that the pink is the rhodopsin of the solar-powered pumps. And for another example of extremophiles that are archaea that have field marks and habitats that are interpretable and identifiable, here's a favorite of mine, the methanogens. And you can perhaps tell by their name that they are doing something with methane. Methanogen means generating methane, making methane. And here's another example of a parallel universe. Here's another example of a whole group of microbes living out of sight, out of reach, really out of our perception. It's very difficult for us to even conceive of what it's like to live where they're living, and yet, conveniently enough, not all that far away from us. Here are organisms that are living deep in sediments, in ponds, and in swamps, in any place where there's some kind of black or brown muck that is the sort of thing that suggests that larger organisms can't live there, but don't think of it as an area where no organisms are living at all. That's where the methanogens and all of their accompanying bacteria are living. So let me see if I can explain what a little bit of their life looks like and allude a little bit to some of the strange metabolisms that are going down there, but really then focus on the methane part of the story, because that's the part of the story that will allow you to catch a glimpse of them. In a previous lecture, I said that the archaea have many bacteria-like properties, and they can certainly look like bacteria. That is to say, they don't look like much of anything. They look like little tiny punctuation points, but they can have enough bacterial properties that they were mistaken for bacteria. But then I said that they were really doing their own version of certain metabolisms, their own kind of heterotrophy, their own kind of autotrophy. And for now, think of autotrophy as making their own food. And a lot of that has to do with using methane. Now, methane is something that we usually associate with maybe a methane burning lamp or stove, perhaps, or methane in the context of something that might explode if it were misused in some way. It doesn't seem very close to anything nutritious. So the surprising thing and the interesting thing about the methanogens is it's very much the foundation of nutrition in their particular little world, deep in the swamp or deep underneath a pond that has black or brown muck. They are making methane. Some of the other organisms in their community are then using that methane for their own metabolism, and yet other organisms are supplying some of the raw materials for making methane. So we have a little cycle of the sort that we simply don't have up on the surface. We don't see much of anything going on with methane up on the surface. We have to dig down to find this little community. It's very much a microbial community, and the centerpiece of it is very much the archaea that make methane. They're the only microorganisms that can make methane. So let's say you wanted to get a look at some of these. I would look for their field mark. Methane is their field mark. So you can, if you're driving past a landfill, where there's been a huge garbage dump at one point, but they've covered it over with some kind of topping of land and usually grass, you will probably see vent pipes everywhere. Those are vent pipes that are channeling the methane from the methanogens out of the landfill and out into the open air. If they did not do that, there would be a collection of methane, pockets of methane underneath the landfill, and it happens to be extremely flammable. And if it's confined, it's explosive. So it's actually dangerous to allow it to accumulate down there. And ordinarily, methane is immediately used by another member of the methane community. But in a landfill, there's sometimes some fairly unusual situations going on due to it being a landfill. And so to prevent any excess methane from occurring, it's vented out. So I would say that's your first field mark, going past the landfill and noticing that there are vent pipes everywhere. That's to handle the methanogens. Sometimes those vent pipes are even set on fire to burn off the methane, although that's a less common practice nowadays. If you're canoeing in a pond where you know that the muds beneath or the sediments beneath are deep and they're very finely particled, you can stick your canoe paddle or a long stick down and twist it around a little bit, and up will come bubbles, and those will be bubbles of methane. You can even go about trying to collect methane in such environments. There have been all sorts of methods suggested for it, but you're essentially putting down some sort of a container filled with water, and as you stir the muds beneath, the gas will displace the water, and you can eventually get a container with some methane gas in it, which I will say again, it is flammable, so it's something to be careful of. Another source of methane is your own intestines. You will sometimes release in ordinary flatulence methane along with other interesting gases. And I'll say that methane is odorless. but it is flammable. So you're releasing, in some cases, a flammable gas. And another major place where you can detect methanogens in action is in sewers. And it's why sewer workers often wear methane detectors. And it's why sewer workers sometimes get hurt in explosions in sewers, because there are methanogens down there, again, in the deep muck that you're likely to have in a sewer, producing methane. If that methane gets collected anywhere, and if there's a spark, maybe from electricity or some other source, there could be an explosion right there. So that means that methane detectors are a way to also detect the natural signs of methanogens. And I will suggest something that I've tried myself. I happen to work at a college that owns some methane detectors for that exact reason. I've gotten permission to borrow those methane detectors. They're relatively easy to use. Pretty simple, actually. They make a little clicking sound in the presence of methane. And it's great fun to go out to a swamp and dig up some sediments and see if you can get the methane detector to click in response to the methane being released. So that's worth trying. And I will point out that you may be surprised at how many places of work have methane detectors for that reason. And it might be worth, you know, asking around and seeing whether you can get the loan of one. So to conclude this lecture, this has been about extremophiles, and there's been a focus mostly on archaea, only the halophiles and only the methanogens, or excuse me, only the archaea are halophiles and methanogens, and many archaea are hyper- and thermophiles. And these are accessible, surprisingly accessible, in spite of their extremophily, or maybe it's because they're extremophiles that they're so accessible, that when you go looking for them, you don't see anything else obscuring your view, and there are their field marks right there. In the next lecture, I want to introduce a group of bacteria called the proteobacteria. And in this case, I will be dealing with, well, probably thousands and thousands of species that we know, and yet probably more thousands that we do not have identified yet. And so I'll have to be very selective as to which ones I tell you about, and I will focus in particular on ones that I think are accessible and that have particularly interesting stories with them.
This ends Lecture 6. If you borrow this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.